Think about the changes to the heavily wooded areas in our region in the last 20 years. Timber country is a different place now, with the Northwest Forest Plan in place on federal lands and a corresponding reduction in timber cutting. Today's guest put out a book of essays 20 years ago about life in timber country. He reshaped and added material to the 20th anniversary edition of the book called Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country. Robert Leo Heilman, Bob Heilman, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange and obviously the author of the essays. Bob, thanks for joining us on the Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you live in Myrtle Creek and been there for quite some time now, I understand.
Yes, I've been living in Myrtle Creek, Oregon, which is up in Douglas County on the South Umpqua River country. For 40 years now.
There's a great story you were just telling me a minute ago. I did not realize you had a connection to Jefferson Public Radio before it was even called that back in the day. But you first got paid for writing some radio features here at what was then KSOR.
That is correct, yeah. One of my early break-ins writing was unpaid, working for the Siskiyou Regional Education Project, which was a bioregional group originally headquartered in Tequilma, but later here in Ashland. And in the process, Howard Lemaire, who was also involved with the group, managed to get a grant from the Carpenter Foundation of Medford to produce a series called the Bioregional Report. And so we were covering Southern Oregon and Northern California, dealing with social and environmental issues as well, doing 5 to 7 minute programs. And so, yeah, that was, in fact, 1985, Ronald Reagan was president back then, and it was quite a while ago.
Even then, 10 years before the original publication of Overstory Zero, there is a story about the reemergence of this book. Why is it out again?
Well, it's in large part, really. What happened was that I, of course, managed to sell the thing to Sasquatch Books of Seattle, and spent a year putting it all together and getting it off into print. Doing a reading at the University of Oregon, the editor there of Oregon Quarterly, the U of O alumni mag, asked me to write an essay, which I did. It was about working with an old Gippo logger many years before, who had since passed away. And I remember at the time thinking, dang, I sure wish that had been in the book. And, of course, 20 years since then of writing these literary nonfiction pieces, several of them are ones that struck me as, boy, that would really fit into the book if only I had written them before 1994. So I had this desire all along to do that, and I'm very pleased and very happy to be able to put this 20th anniversary edition out.
So there's a material that was not in the original version of Overstory Zero, and did a few things end up leaving the book, too?
I cut one piece. There was a piece called Fuji and the War on Young Men, which originally appeared in West Wind Review from Southern Oregon College, which it was at the time. And I cut that one because it was about being an 18-year-old draft dodger back in 1970 and being arrested for vagrancy in Kingman, Arizona. That didn't really have anything to do with the Umpqua country where I live. And so I cut that one to help make room for the 10 other pieces that I added to this.
So when you talk about the Umpqua country and the community in which you live now, I mean, has it changed greatly in the 20 years since you first published Overstory Zero?
Yes, in a lot of ways. For one thing, we've lost an awful lot of our young people. The county has aged tremendously as young people with families move out for lack of jobs, and they are being replaced in a sort of process of fossilization, if you will. A lot of elderly retirees move into the area. And so this, in turn, has a great effect. We're losing a lot of our rural character. It's becoming more and more sort of almost a suburban bedroom community kind
of place. Suburbs of mud.
Yes, yeah, with rural gentrification and all of that. We're seeing these white vinyl fencing around that never used to be there. And it's one of the ways you can pretty much tell when somebody has just come in from the area.
And these are the same 20 years in which the Northwest Forest Plan came into full effect, and we had all the timber cutting reductions going on. I mean, I'm sure there were people, in effect, I think some of the reference in the book who had talked about the coming collapse. The timber industry is just going to collapse under the Northwest Forest Plan. That hasn't happened, has it?
Well, the federal end of it is down to about 10% of the levels that we had during the height of the cutting during the 1980s. So on the federal land, yes, it's not completely dead, but virtually so. However, certainly within Douglas County, we're at roughly 60% all told. Traditionally, two-thirds of the cut, and that cut traditionally was 1 billion board feet per year out of our county from 1950 to 1990. Two-thirds of that, 650,000 board feet a year, was coming off of private lands, another 350 million off of the federal lands. So we're looking at roughly maybe 30 million now coming off the federal lands, but another 565 million board feet a year coming off of the corporate and private lands.
You have really kept up with the numbers over the years, I can tell.
Well, I live there. I care about the place deeply, and people ask me these questions, so it's good to know the answers.
What brought you to Merrill Creek in the first place 40 years ago?
My brother had moved to Days Creek, which is on the upriver from Myrtle Creek. I had visited him there. I tried living first in northern New Mexico, and it was just too rough there. And my wife and I ended up moving back to Los Angeles for a year or two. And then one day we were talking about the possibility of getting a dog. And I told her that, Los Angeles is not a good place to own a dog. And, of course, the notion then occurred to me that, well, if it's no good for dogs, it's probably no good for kids. And if I want to raise a kid, then I should move. And we did. We moved to Myrtle Creek in May of 1975.
And the rest is history. Much more to talk about with Bob Heilman. His book is Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country, the 20th Anniversary Edition. Back with Bob and you if you'd like to join us in a minute five. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Myrtle Creek author Robert Leo Heilman, Bob Heilman he prefers to be called. His book, Overstory Zero, which first came out in 1994, is out again in a 20th anniversary edition with updated material. Real Life in Timber Country is the subtitle and the essence of the book. It's about real interesting people and situations in the backcountry of Douglas County. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, 800-837-60. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Check out Bob's picture on Facebook as well. In the book, you say there's something to be said for living in a backwater, which I think you gave a good setup to as we were coming into the break about Los Angeles is probably not a great place to have a dog and maybe not the best of places to have kids either. So is that, I mean, a lot to be said about living in a backwater.
Well, yeah, it's nice when people don't pay attention to you. You can get away with more. As long as you're willing to accept that and, you can develop your own culture, which I think is a wonderful thing. It's one of the great challenges when I think of the state of Jefferson, you know. I don't really have much faith in it as a political entity, but culturally and artistically, there's a lot of very interesting things that could go on here if we can recognize ourselves as neighbors, as a culture that is somewhat different. You know, the land shapes our thinking and our feelings. In that sense, yes, it is good, you know. And the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu, says to keep under is to endure, you know. The big shots are the ones who get shot down. The little people get by.
We're happy in our small pond, is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly.
When you talk about people in the state of Jefferson thinking of themselves as neighbors, do you think there's still some sense of division or at least a sense of like, well, yeah, we're in the, you know, quote-unquote state of Jefferson, but we're in Oregon or we're in California?
Well, yeah, there is certainly differences between Oregon and California, at least, you know, towards, you know, in the just politically the way things are done, you know. But I think we need to think less of ourselves as things, as it were, as conservatives or liberals, as counterculture, as, you know, Christians, as this and that, taking on these identities through ideology is not helpful, you know. I think what we need to do is to look around and to recognize and to acknowledge that the common ground is here beneath our feet, that we live in our real communities, and that these communities have a great deal of diversity in them. And as a result, we need to respect each other. And this is something that I have found to be somewhat in decline, you know. I did the census, worked as a census taker in 1990, and did the same gig again in 2010. And there was a great deal of difference in how people received me.
Really? As a guy from the government or something?
Right, exactly. Yeah, earlier on, it was much more of an acknowledgement that, you know, hey, you're just a guy out doing a job, and, you know, you're my neighbor and such like. But boy, did I come in for it quite often, you know. I just found myself thinking, well, yeah, I'll just have to tell Mr. Obama all about that next time we have a beer together, you know.
Bob Hyland, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country, a collection of essays from many years in Myrtle Creek. You know, when you were talking about the diversity in the country, it seems like probably when you arrived in Myrtle Creek, there was probably a healthy confluence of and, you know, here we talked about not using labels, I'm going to use them all, but you had loggers, you had hippies, you had probably a whole bunch of different kinds of people living in this fairly small town and finding ways to get along with each other as well.
Well, yeah, more, you know, there were an awful lot of hippies who were loggers, you know.
Really?
I was one of them. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, the Hodads, tree planting co-op was very active. There was a lot of work out in the woods, and people were, you know, much more willing to accept you once they realized that you were respectful and that, you know, you were trying to stay in the place and do well by the place and by, you know, by your neighbors and such. Neighborliness is again, a quality that is you find in rural places more than you do in urban places. In urban places, people practice civility more than they do neighborliness. The word neighbor, in fact, comes from the German Nachbauer, the near farmer.
Oh, really?
And, of course, so it's the difference between being urbane and being boorish.
Huh, okay. That's an interesting distinction to make there. In the first essay called An Occupational Disease, you write that we are all loggers in our own way. What do you mean by that?
Well, in that particular piece, what I was talking about was the what happens to people when they work. When they're at work, you got a boss, you have company rules that you have to abide by. There is a certain cold-heartedness that can come with that very easily, you know. We can just be wonderful, loving people at home and all of that, and good church-going folks and whatnot, and then practice these things that, you know, harm people. They're harmful and cruel. And, you know, why does that come about? Where does this indifference come about, you know? Why do we say to people, I'm sorry, but it's company policy?
Well, you know, and it's right on the next page, after the reference to loggers, that you talk about money as a poison in all human relations.
I believe it is, frankly, you know, and I think that we see that so much in the free market ideology that people buy into now, almost as if it were a religion, really. The profit and loss is simply not the most important thing in life. Economic profit and loss is just, you know, yes, it's important. It's important for the economy, but the economy itself is not the most important thing. The most important thing is how we treat each other. How we treat each other allows us to survive. And to me, morality is based on that, on survival. What helps us to get by, to sustain ourselves here in the place where we live? And that which contributes to that is good, and that which harms it is bad.
It seems like very early on here you're getting into the complexity of working in nature and taming it at the same time. I mean, you can love the outdoors, but you're also working to change it at the same time. I've run across a few loggers over the years who said, yeah, I really love working outdoors. You know, so you want to cut trees, but you can't cut them all and continue to work. So this level of complexity in our relationship with nature that you clearly have spent a fair amount of time thinking about.
Well, the timber controversy is much more complex than people tend to put out. It's billed as owls versus jobs, environmentalists versus timber folks. The reality of it, if you really study it and you look into it, you can trace things clear back to Teddy Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot. You can then the establishment of the U.S. Forest Service. There's elements in there. A great deal of it has to do with the studies that were done by Oregon State University back in the 1950s regarding what is sustainable and what is not, which were hopelessly optimistic, to say the least. There is the question of what is called sustained yield, which is actually almost a euphemism really for maximum yield, which is to say let us try to produce as much wood fiber as we possibly can as quickly as possible, which, by the way, it turned out to be a false doctrine. You cannot sustain a forest that way. Sustainable forestry means you show up in a forest, you do some logging, you leave, and there's still a forest there. And that's the difference. And so all of the research that we've come across, the scientific research over the past, you know, starting in the late 1970s, has been consistently showing that we have to take less and less and less, and that we have to take it more and more cleverly, more respectfully, more carefully. Sanity consists of a broad range of concerns when you make a decision. Insanity is always a very narrow matter. And the insanity of basing everything on economic concern only is really akin to sociopathy, really, and it's destructive, and it hurts people, it hurts communities, it hurts the lands, it hurts the critters. We need to look at the broadest possible range of considerations when we make these decisions, whether that happens to be timber or management questions, whether they are social questions, you know, such as, you know, accepting and rejecting certain groups of people, clinging to certain ideologies and things. You need to have a very, very broad, and indeed, you know, as we advance technologically, there's a greater and greater need to do that, to take into the broadest possible range of considerations when you make a decision on how to act within the world.
Bob Heilman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a writer and the author of all the essays in the book Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country, now out in a 20th anniversary edition. I can let you know that he'll be appearing later this week at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland the evening of the 29th, which would be that Thursday evening?
Thursday at 7 p.m.
Thursday at 7 o'clock at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland with an author talk. He's here now on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join in 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. The title of the collection, for folks who don't know things like understory removal and overstory and all that stuff, what does it mean, Overstory Zero?
The title is from the title essay, which is about planting trees, which is something that's done on clear cuts, or at least it was when back in the days when I was swinging a hodad out there and pumping them in at the rate of 700 or 800 trees a day. The overstory is the top layer of the forest canopy. When it measures 0.0 inches, you're standing in a clear cut. There is no overstory, you see. It came about, I was working on a clear cut for what was then Roseburg Lumber Company. It's now Roseburg Forest Products Company. But anyway, we're up the North Umpqua River working on a piece. I was curious about it. I wondered how long ago was it logged? How many times have we tried to plant this thing and get trees to come back on it? The answer turned out to be 20 years before, during the mid-1950s, and we were going over it for the third time to try and establish some trees on there because it just had been mishandled. In doing so, I checked out my foreman's clipboard, in which he had a sheet of paper, and on the sheet of paper were a series of boxes giving, you know, the dates of different things that were done there, different measurements, the elevation, the aspect, etc. And one of the boxes was marked overstory, and next to it was a big fat zero with a line through it. And I thought that was rather strange.
No overstory whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, apparently there's still a forest there. It just happens to be one whose overstory measures 0 inches, you see.
So it's still technically a forest on that piece of paper, but yeah.
Well, yeah, in the thinking of industrial civil culture, yes, there is no depletion at all.
Yeah, I should point out that the picture right under the title makes it pretty clear what's going on here, because it's a picture of a valley of stumps.
Yes.
There's your overstory zero. You in that that very essay, Overstory Zero, you describe yourself on that tree planting mission as a grizzled old timer by your mid-20s. How tough a life is that out there planting trees?
It is the toughest work that I know of, and I've done shingling in New Mexico in the summertime. I've dug ditches. I've been logging. I've set chokers, fallen timber, skin cat. I've worked in the mill. I've pulled planer chain. I've peeled poles by hand, telephone poles 60 feet long by hand. There is nothing like tree planting. The nearest equivalent I can think of is, say, a 5-mile cross-country run every day up and down the mountainsides.
That hard.
it really is. It's, you know, you stop and think about it now. 700 trees in 8 hours means you're planting one every 41 seconds.
Ow.
8 feet apart.
So hoe dead with the right hand, plant with the left, cover
boom,
back
boom,
up.
Boom, 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 boom. Scalp, yep. Scalp, scalp, stub, stab, 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 stuff, stomp, split, move on. And the foreman liked to see you moving. you don't get to dawdle.
How? What was your favorite job, though, of all the stuff you've done outdoors?
Setting chokers on a cat show is restful. Because it takes the bulldozer a while to haul the stuff to the landing and come back, and so you get a chance to actually sit down and look around you and appreciate things. So that's been a lot of fun, working out in the woods. I did do some contracts, cone picking and shade carting and such. And those were fun because they were family affairs, you know, small Bureau of Land Management contracts and such.
You had mentioned gypo loggers earlier in the conversation. I want to come back to that because it's a term that I think you said is getting nearly obsolete in the region. What is a gypo logger?
A gypo is a small-time operator, in essence, somebody who has a very kind of precarious existence and is therefore likely to gyp you out of your pay when you work for them. That's the origin of the word, anyway. It's come it's as you said, it's nearly obsolete now.
Just because the larger timber companies are the ones that manage to stay in business and they tend to work with their own crews?
Well, that, there was sort of a, right after World War II, there was a period in which there were an awful lot of these small independent operations. You know, all you really needed was a chainsaw and a pickup, or you know, and a small dozer or something, and you could make some money out in the woods. But there was a sort of technological arms race that came along, you know, these million-dollar yarders and things, this constant push, again, to increase production so that you can do things more cheaply, therefore make a greater profit, send more logs to the mill per day, faster and cheaper. And after a while, it just got to the point where the small-time operators really couldn't compete.
Bob Heilman's again our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country, now out in a 20th anniversary edition. And it is, as the subtitle suggests, about life in timber country. Bob's been living in Myrtle Creek for about 40 years now. We'll come back and talk more with him about the items in the book and about life in the country in general. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Bob and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. The Jefferson Exchange returns in a minute 25. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Robert Leo Heilman, a writer who lives in rural Douglas County in the Myrtle Creek area. He put out a collection of stories 20 years ago called Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country. It has been updated, more stuff put in, one thing taken out, the part about draft dodgers we learned today. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Bob Heilman about life in the country and his observations of it. Our phone number on the exchange, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Couple of points to bring up here. Number one, you were talking about all the things that you've done in the timber business, including peeling bark off telephone poles, which you write in the essay Monday Morning that this is a job only for old men. Why?
Well, I used to work for McCormick Piling Company in Riddle, Oregon, near my home. In fact, I would walk to work and home every day. It was a piecework operation. We were getting 7 cents a foot for peeling the bark off of future telephone poles. It was probably the last hand-peeling operation in Oregon. It's all done by machine nowadays. These young guys would show up looking for work, and they'd tie into a load of barkies, as we called them, and never finish it. It just happened over and over and over again. However, there were a number of these old-timers, retirees and such in their 60s and 70s, and they worked at it very steady, you know. And it amazed me, you know, to watch them. They were so used to manual labor, and they understood what they were doing as well. They knew the tools. They knew the job. They knew how to use a PV, how to use spud bars, how to use a double bit axe to knock the knots off the sides of it and everything else. And so it used to amaze me because I had a hard time keeping up with them. They would outwork me, and yet here I was, a young buck in my 20s. I would be coming right off of a winter of planting trees. I was just tough as nails, and yet here's these old guys, and they're beating me. Why is it that they're always ahead of me, you know? So part of it, of course, is the old guys have patience. They have technique. They have a lifetime of experience doing manual labor. And so they fit right in, but very few of the younger people did.
You have such a great power of observation, which I've noticed from talking to writers over the years, is something that you kind of have to be a decent writer. And having talked to all the timber workers that you talked to over the years, I wonder if you've observed a certain level of resignation in being at the end of a trail of decisions made by people who are far away from where they're actually doing the work.
Yeah, it's really the saddest part of the whole mess to me. I think that the timber workers themselves are the least to be blamed for any of it, you know. These are decent people who are just trying to make a living, trying to preserve a way of life that's very much endangered. And so it's, you know, it's very sad that way. A lot of them are now doing other things. Last winter did an interview with two barbers, father and son. The father had been a mill supervisor for 25 years, something like that. His son had worked in a different mill for a good 20 years or so. Both of those mills are gone, and now they've turned to running a barbershop, a father-son barbershop in Roseburg. They miss it. They miss that life. They miss, you know, not just the wages and the benefits and all of that, but just working with wood and being involved in the industry.
You had some observations in one of these essays about wages in the timber industry that you wanted to get to, I understand.
Yeah, this is one of the things that is very difficult to get people to talk about for some reason. I used to argue quite a bit with some of the more radical environmentalists back in the 80s and such, Earth Firsters and all, about this. But they don't want to talk about it. The industry doesn't want to talk about it. The fact is that overall, within about a seven-year period between 1979 and 1986, there was an 18% drop in timber industry wages. Just the average timber worker made about 18% less in pay. This at a time when the harvest levels were at record highs, historic highs. So it's not as though there was any sort of, you know, a lack of work to be done that was driving it. It was simply the lean and mean days, you see. We had the Reagan recession of the early 80s, mm-hmm. and lean and mean was the big word back then, which was, you know, supposed to be we were going to increase productivity. But in reality, what happened was that the bosses got mean and the workers got lean. I mentioned that in a piece that I wrote called Getting By, which is all about surviving the Reagan recession of the early 80s. And I'll read you a little piece from that. It's just a few paragraphs, okay, if you don't mind. Davey was my neighbor's son when we lived in town. He and I worked on the same tree planting crew for a local mill during the winter of 1976. In the spring of that year, he got a job in the mill. He was 18, fresh out of high school, and earning $5.35 an hour. In the spring of 1986, I ran into him in the grocery store. He'd been out of work for nearly a year, but had just landed a job in another mill. He was grateful to have found work, which I could understand, since he was now 28, married, and a father. "Well, that's good to hear," I congratulated him. "How much are you making?" $4.75 an hour," he said. I should have kept my mouth shut, but a little mental arithmetic told me that, given the inflation rate, he was earning about half the pay he had as a raw kid. "Jeez, you guys are still eligible for food stamps," I blurted. He looked away, over at the stacked boxes of margarine, before he spoke. "Yeah, well, actually, I'm getting more than most of the guys, because I've got experience. Starting pay's $4 an hour."
Bob Heilman reading from Overstory Zero, his collection of stories, Real Life in Timber Country, that from Getting By. That particular essay begins with a quote from an economic development report from CCD, which I guess was the Coos Kerry Douglas Business Development Corporation from 1986, about the efficiency of the timber industry after the recession of the early 1980s. Contrast this thing about how, well, the timber industry is going to be so much more efficient now in this report to your description in that whole essay, Getting By, about the misery you saw.
Well, it's I have a great fondness for jive. when people try to put the best face on things, you know, it struck me as just horrible that here's this report that is typifying the closing of mills and the running of people out of work as a good thing for the industry. Saying, oh, it's a, you know, all in all, yes, it's been tough, but all in all, it's a good thing for the industry. Yeah, well, it might be good for the industry, but if the industry consists of people, of workers, of communities, then it's not a good thing at all.
How did you get by back then?
I don't know. I really don't understand. I was lamed up. I had fallen off of a roof in October of 1980. Spent many years just trying to deal with chronic pain. We had a two-year-old son at the time. I was staying home and raising him while my wife tried to help us survive. We did quite a bit of subsistence farming kind of stuff. Had a milk cow, some chickens, garden, you know, these sorts of things, just doing whatever we could to try and scrape by for a few years.
There's a great little vignette in the essay Monday Morning about in the country you can be broke and still eat better than a bank president because of the stuff you're able to grow yourself there.
Well, that is true, you know, and yes, it is possible to go out and poach some venison once in a while and fishing and these sorts of things. God knows a lot of what we did was illegal in order to get by, but we did it because you just do what you have to do to sustain yourself, to stay, to survive. Unfortunately, an awful lot of my friends didn't. There was a lot of divorce, there was domestic violence. There was just, you know, terrible, terrible things that happen in a town. When you lose, we lost not only, the layoffs from the timber industry, but there was also a mine, a large nickel mine.
Riddle. The Hanna nickel mine?
Yeah. The Hanna mine that shut down. And so all of a sudden, this town that had just been rip-roaring along is facing fewer jobs, much, much fewer jobs, much lower wages, an exodus of people. We lost a sizable proportion of our workforce just within a two-year period or so after the unemployment checks ran out and all of that. So it was a terrible thing to witness.
We have a call here. We have Julian Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Bob Heilman about his observations of life in timber country and Overstory Zero.
Hi, thank you. I just want to say I appreciate your perspective and that you've gone to the trouble to write it. You felt moved to write it. I really appreciate your historical caring of what you were doing, of all the logging and how it's evolved through these recent years. And I really feel it's an important document, really, what you've documented by your experience. And that maybe we can carry the caring of the trees and the forest forward by looking back on what we've done and how industry kind of provoked how things inspired. So I don't know I just don't want people like you to die off and there goes the voice for the forest, you know. So thank you for what you've done.
All right. Thank you for that call, Julie. Let's go to John and Vanita. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, she beat me to it, I guess. In a way, I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian. I grew up in the middle of all this stuff, and I want to thank you for recording this, putting this down, because it's fading away. I'm about your age. I really feel what you're saying, man. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, John. Any thoughts back, Bob?
It always amazes me that anybody gives a damn about anything I wrote, and I'm hugely grateful when that happens to me. Writing is such an isolated task. I sit alone in a room with me in a computer screen, and even when I get things done and I'm sending it off to somebody in the industry, to an editor somewhere, to a magazine or whatever. It's all done very remotely, you see. And so the chance to hear from readers is just immensely gratifying. It's always very, very gratifying. And the ones that mean the most to me are when I hear from people who've had the same sort of experiences as I have. God knows the book got enough praise from the critics, 35 rave reviews when it came out in 95. But to hear from ordinary folks, people who are just, you know, blue-collar people like myself, and to get, you know, a letter from Homer, Alaska, or someplace like that, is immensely gratifying and encouraging as well. And writers do need to be encouraged, and it is the readers who give them the courage to carry on. So I can't thank you folks enough.
One final question here about the essay called The Politics and Prejudice of Old Growth, in which you write, failing to take the true measure of opponents is an all too familiar failing among political activists. You think anybody's learned that lesson in 20 years?
Some have and some haven't. Unfortunately, political activism, as Eric Hoffer pointed out, tends to draw a great many people who use their activism as a way to try to make up for whatever inadequacies they happen to feel in their own lives. And so you're dealing with dissatisfied people a lot. This is leads to an awful lot of trouble. And particularly it leads to trouble when you have sociopaths who are using that fear and that anger and that frustration to further their own ends.
The reading at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland with Bob Heilman is Thursday night, January 29th, 7 to 8 o'clock. And the book, you'll recognize a lot of what you know from living in this part of the world in Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country. Bob Heilman, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's been an honor.
Same here. Very much a pleasure.